Nation with 5% of the world's population now consumes 80% of the world's opioids and sits back and watches as 60,000 of its citizens are killed by those opioids each year. So we pause to ask, how did the U.S. become Opioid Nation?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,138th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Tappeeque who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with our engineer, Griffin Queener, on the boards. Griffin, good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to have you aboard. Also have producer Sarah Bell Lynn on the stories. Folks, get this number here. 58,220 Americans lost their lives during the 19 years of the Vietnam War. And that war tore our nation's social fabric to shreds. But in just 1 year of the opioid war, 2016, 60,000 Americans were killed in action, and the nation sits numbed by these numbers. If the opium war goes on as it is going on, those numbers will likely catch up to each and every one of us, and they will become very, very personal. Such was the experience of Bradley DeHaven, whose athlete son, a young man of 14, was transformed into a drug-driven felon by virtue of falling off a trampoline one day. What DeHaven discovered about the opioid war and what he had to do to save his son's freedom leads us to ask, how did the United States of America become Opioid Nation? Who better to ask than Bradley DeHaven, who is the author of, Defining Moment, A Suburban Father's Journey into His Son's Oxy Addiction, and How to Prevent, Detect, Treat, and Live with the Addict Among Us. Bradley, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thank you very much.
Folks, I met Bradley in a professional context, a different kind of professional context, and he started somehow being the journalist in me, started prying around, and holy smokes, what an incredible experience in life he has led simply by virtue of his son, a 14-year-old, falling off a trampoline one day. You became an international expert, probably all against your intentions, never thought of doing it, but it all started that day that your son fell off the trampoline, right, Bradley?
Yep, the accidental advocate.
Accidental advocate. Which means you didn't try to or plan to, but you did, and you had to.
That's true.
So you were in Sacramento, California, living a good suburban life, a financial planner, had a family, life was good.
Yeah, two boys, lived in Granite Bay, which is a affluent suburb of the Sacramento area, and thought I coached my kids' sports. I was there for them. I actually officed out of my house for a while, and their school backed up to our house so I could actually see them from my office on the playground. So I was there for them. I coached 7 seasons of football, 7 seasons of soccer, 3 seasons of tackle football, and tried to be that father. So you think
all
that you're
around
doing...
All around dad, yeah. All around son, all around city, USA.
You Sacramento. Can be doing everything you think is right, and addiction can still creep into your family.
A sports injury. Kind of go through it really quickly. Fell off the trampoline, broke his arm.
Yeah, pretty typical. He was jumping around at a neighbor's house on a trampoline and took a wrong step, hit the edge, and broke his arm. It didn't seem like, anything out of the ordinary to us, but, you take him to the doctor, you get the arm set, and then they prescribe some medication. It's your doctor. You trust them. You give them one every 3 or 4 hours or whatever they tell you to do, and a few years later, you find out that what you were giving your kid is an opioid, and it's highly addictive, and he did become very addicted, obviously. And
it took you 3 years, though, to think of...
It took more than that. I mean, we knew, you know, you can easily, as a parent, pass off the symptoms of addiction as just being a teenage pain in the rear. They get very distant. They get kind of dark. They, you know, don't want to be in family events, blah, blah, blah. It's the same symptoms that you, as a parent, can easily dismiss as typical teenage antics.
Angst.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the angsters among us, yeah.
Yeah.
And, but you did pick up on it later, and it did take you into a world you never thought you'd find yourself in, did it not?
Sure, yeah. Unbeknownst to us, he was getting medication from other people's medicine cabinets and working us as parents for the doctor. If you think about most of the drugs that are highly addictive, they're all for conditions that you cannot take a test for. For instance, pain. The doctor will ask you, what's your level of pain? It's not like there's a, you know.
1, 2, 3, 4, or 5.
Right, yeah.
How much do you hurt?
1 to 10, or gee, you tell a doctor you can't sleep at night and you're getting benzos like Xanax and Valium and things like that. You tell a doctor that you can't pay attention and you're getting Adderall and those kind of things. But these are all things there is no blood test for to say, yeah, you have that condition.
So as your life is going along, your son is withdrawing, playing you, playing the doctors, playing his friends and everybody else.
Yeah, the addiction is really clear when you look back. When you look back at all the symptoms and add them up, and there isn't, I've talked to hundreds of addicts, hundreds of parents of addicts, and we would all agree that you look back and all those symptoms are as clear as day, but when they were happening, you dismiss them as quick as you see them.
And in this process, your son got into legal trouble and you had to go down deep to get him out.
That's true. He eventually, I remember telling him, he ended up moving out. He was 18, 19 years old. He ended up moving out, moving in with some friends or, you know, fellow addicts, I'm sure. And I just remember telling him and telling my wife that, one of a couple things is going to happen to you. You're either going to get arrested and that's going to be the good thing, or you're going to die from this.
So you knew by then, by the time he was 18.
He was out of control. We knew. The amount of lies and the drama, it all just, by then we really knew. And he had come to us a couple times wanting help. But as parents, you think you can help, but it's just ignorance. You think, they got addicted around you. You're the worst person in the world to treat addiction as a parent. You think you want to usher this in your back room, but it'd be like if your kid showed up with a growth on their neck and you said, you know what, Johnny, go in your bedroom. Let's cut that out and see what that is. You need to seek professional help as soon as you see anything. And it is something that was our dirty little secret. So we didn't want to share it with friends, family, and physicians.
So you and the wife didn't want anybody to know what was really going on there.
No, of course not. Back then, it was over 10 years ago, we felt like we were leopards, you know, that nobody would understand us. We would soon find out that that we weren't, and many of our friends were really surprised to find out that our family was going through that. In fact, the working title for my first book, which started as just me writing cathartically, was Beyond the Picket Fence, because I really felt like it was on our side of the fence, you know, looking in from across the street, the neighbors probably thought everything was normal, but it was a disaster.
You know, it's interesting, when we started talking here in the radio station this morning, I asked around, there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4 of us here in the studio this morning. Each one of us has had our family life touched by this epidemic.
Yeah.
Each one of us.
I've spoken to a lot of groups, and sometimes I'll tell them, you know, that I could grab a handful of sand and throw it at this audience and I wouldn't waste a grain. I'd hit somebody that's affected at some level or afflicted at some level by addiction in their family. If not immediate family, then somebody they know, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, whatever.
I almost think it would be easier to do it the other way, you know, to not hit somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost impossible now, given what we saw just with a quick survey of what's going on here. And then you became an author and a consultant and a star of documentaries, and you kind of became a national authority unwittingly and accidentally.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote the first book, Defining Moments, and Defining Moments was the story about how I went deep to get Brandon out of his addiction and get him the professional help that he needed, because he was facing 5 years of jail time. And some of the things I did are the things that go thump in the night that make you really kind of look at your life. So I started journaling and writing it down because I just couldn't sleep at night. And that became my first book, which was Defining Moments. And once I wrote my first book and it started to get out there and got it published, then I started getting calls from, at first, local radio stations and things like that. And it led up from there.
Away you go. Yeah. Now you're the star of stage screen. And
I don't know about that.
But we do have an expert, somebody who is an expert from both sides of it. You know, it's an expert from actually living it. You know, we look at the numbers and they numb us and we don't think, oh, it can't happen here. But ladies and gentlemen, it is going to happen here. Sooner or later, somewhere along the line, somebody in your family is going to get taken. And it's going to take you to places where you just don't want to go. And that's the subject we're tackling today. How did the United States of America, a country with 5% of the population, come to consume 80% of the world's opioids? What happened to the USA? Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value special crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, addiction is not about you until it is about you. And then when it is about you, what do you do then? That really was the story of Bradley DeHaven and his 14-year-old son who fell off a trampoline one day many years ago, decade ago or so, and broke his arm. Took it to the doctor. The doctor patched it up and said, here, take this. How did it go from taking that to that addiction?
Well, addiction's a slippery slope, and it's not just children. You know, it's people my age, too, people of all ages. You something happens to you. You get prescribed something. You like the way it feels or makes you feel, and you keep taking it. And before you know it, you're taking more and more, and you know, you find yourself arguing with your doctor about wanting more, and it's a very slippery slope. It's sad when you see jokes. It's like the Olympic ice skater who made a joke the other day in his interview about, oh, that was stressful, I need a drink and a Xanax. And I thought, how irresponsible of somebody that age to say something like that, because those days are over. The days of standing by the water cooler and your coworker saying, oh, I couldn't take all this Vicodin, oh, I'll take it. You don't share drugs and meds. You need to be responsible with them. And you need to, as a person, as a father, or even for yourself, as a parent, whatever your capacity is, you need to understand that getting off of these meds is more important than continuing taking these meds. So there should be an exit plan on any medication that you take.
Parents often come to you, say, it's not going to happen to me. My son's a high school football quarterback. My daughter is a cheerleader, homecoming queen.
Right.
My kids have been raised right. Not going to happen.
Exactly. And it's it happens all the time. You know, I used to do a lot more public speaking, especially in Granite Bay, at the high school level. And people come up afterwards and kind of say, oh, sorry, your son's such a screw up, but my son or my daughter will never do that. And here's why. And they would tell me all the reasons why. And I would, you know, having interviewed hundreds of addicts and their stories of how they became addicts and helping parents help extract their kids from addiction or working with them to better understand addiction, you run into that story after the fact. So I do use the term addiction isn't about you until it is, because people just don't think it's about them. They'll say, oh, my daughter is the head of the volleyball team and a star. My son is the high school quarterback. But these are the very same people that after a sports-related injury are prescribed strong medications. And then I ask them, I say, you know, okay, Mr. High School Quarterback, a young man that's now a heroin addict, what happened? And they'll tell me, you know, I tore my ACL. I went in. I got all these meds. I came into school the next day on my crutches. And I'll ask them, what was the number one question everybody asked you? And it's nothing about the injury. It's all about what did they prescribe you? Because those pills have a street value. Back in the day, Oxycontin, 80 milligram Oxycontin pill was $100 a piece. So imagine if a kid got a prescription for 30 Oxycontin. Well, that's a whole bunch of cash in your pocket. So
for a kid, yeah.
Right. So these
new car,
right? Yeah. So the people would begin selling them or trading them, just like Adderall on test day. Adderall's about $5 a pill on test day. It's about $10 a pill. People take it to kind of hype themselves up. It's the old version of speed or a crosstop, which was back in the 70s. But it basically makes them more alert and aware for that test. But then they can become dependent on it. And those getting the prescriptions kind of become dependent on the money, and they are also taking the meds a little bit, and then there's the slippery slope.
So it's a whole economic food chain that develops around the opioids and drugs.
It becomes a commodity. It becomes worth something. So it may not be their drug of choice. Some people go get a prescription for a pain medication for the sole purpose, and I've interviewed hundreds of these people, and for the sole purpose of trading it for something else that they want, whether it's cash or whether it's marijuana instead of the pain pill, whatever it is, it's a commodity. It's money in their pocket if they can get prescribed this pill because they know where they can sell it or trade it for what they desire.
I had an acquaintance who did exactly that. He was an injury freak and was always injured and always going to the doctor and always getting prescriptions for OxyContin. I think he had, you know, dozens of doctors lined up here and there.
Right.
But he was taking these, and this is in San Diego, and he's taking the OxyContins down to Mexico, Tijuana, and selling them for cash, and then coming back across the border with the cash and buying heroin on this side of the border, which was, I was flabbergasted. It just didn't make any sense in my old way of thinking, but everything seems back asswards.
Yeah, people always wonder how someone goes from taking a prescription pill, which has this perception of it's okay, my doctor prescribed it, to going to heroin. In fact, a lot of people, when they start their addiction with prescription pills, think that they're better than that, that they're not that street drug addict, that they are, you know, getting this stuff, you know, comes out of a medicine cabinet in a little bottle with a doctor's name on it, and it's okay. But as you get more addicted, it's the progression into heroin is kind of a natural, you know, thing for people to do. They can't afford and they can't find the quantity to feed their addictions, and their appetite for the drug exceeds their budget. Then they start going to cheaper alternatives such as heroin. You back in the day, you couldn't buy $10 worth of OxyContin, but you could buy $10 worth of heroin. So when you need to get by, you stepped over to that side. Now you were that drug addict that you always said you would never be. And
it's just one decision, one day.
Yeah.
There you are.
Once you roll up that sleeve and inject it, you know, the cat's out of the bag. That's your life. And it's sad. I mean, my son is now 32 years old and has been clean for 8 or 9 years now, almost 9 years. This summer will be 9 years. And, he, by the time he was in his early 20s, had buried over 20 friends to an overdose.
20 friends?
Yes. Been to funeral after funeral after funeral. And the odd thing was, these kids were so high at these funerals because they were trying to mask those feelings. One of the things that being a drug addict does, and when I talked to my son about being sober, he said one of the most difficult things about being clean in the beginning was feeling. And I said, feeling what? And he said, feeling anything, Dad. Feeling hot, feeling cold, sad, happy. I'm not used to any of those feelings. When you're drugged, you don't feel. And he said, when you go to a funeral of a friend, you can't handle that feeling, no way. So a lot of these kids would get super high before they went to the funeral. In fact, there was one case in Granite Bay where a kid overdosed at his friend's funeral. An ambulance actually had to show up and take him away at the funeral.
And so the avoidance of pain.
Yeah, it's it's, you know, they never get the high that they want after they start getting the high. When they first start taking the pills, they like the way it makes them feel. They don't necessarily like the way it makes them feel once they're an addict. They just need that feeling. They need that drug in their system, because I've watched it personally. In one of the documentaries I'm in, Behind the Orange Curtain, which is a great documentary that was filmed out of Orange County, they used footage that I actually filmed of my son going through withdrawals on the floor of our bathroom. And, you know, I filmed it for... my barbaric reason was that I would show it to him afterwards, because he certainly didn't know where he was at. He looked like an animal dying on the floor. And we kept him hydrated, and we, you know, were under, we were using a doctor to help us, you know, with certain things to, so we didn't kill him at home. But back then, we were detoxing our own son at home. And I filmed it because I wanted him to see it afterwards, because I thought if he saw the film, he'd never, ever want to use drugs again. That's how ignorant I was at the time, because it has nothing to do with that. There's an underlying cause. Like I said earlier, people need professional help, and wherever they go, it's better than trying to usher them in the back room and treat it at home, which is exactly what we tried to do, which is some of the mistakes we made as a family.
Okay, another documentary out called The Trade made this statement. The U.S., United States of America, consumes more than 80% of the global opioid pills, even though it has less than 5% of the world's population. I read that, and I guess it was flabbergasted. And then just the other day, I found this full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal from Purdue Pharmaceuticals. It said, "We manufacture prescription opioids. How could we not help fight the prescription and illicit opioid abuse crisis? When we get back with Bradley DeHaven, what happened to the United States of America?"
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back, and we are talking about Opioid Nation. United States of America, ladies and gentlemen, a country with 5% of the population, now consuming 80% of the world's opioid pills. 80%. So, talking with Bradley DeHaven, whose 14-year-old son fell off a trampoline a decade or so ago. Took him to the doctor. Doctor set his arm and gave him a pill, or two or three or hundreds, ended up becoming an addict. When you finally wrestled him into recovery, 6'2", 210-pound young man had become a what?
6'2", 128 pounds. He looked like a Holocaust victim.
And there he was. And when you give presentations, you were off the mic, we were talking about how you gave a presentation. You're one of many people speaking at an event put on by The Cure, which tracks prescription medications, I guess, throughout the food chain, right?
The Cures program is a California program, as a prescription drug monitoring program that's really an unfunded program. And so I was speaking at a hearing on the Cures program to try to get it funded in Sacramento.
And you were different than the rest of the speakers.
Yeah, there was about 100 and some odd parents there. Some of them are my Facebook friends still and fellow advocates. I was one of about a handful of people that actually spoke at the hearing. And when I stood up to the congressmen and senators that were listening to the hearing, I looked at them and I said, "You need to know that I'm different than all these people that are here." And there was all these parents in the audience, over 100 of them, holding pictures of their deceased children who had died of overdoses in the audience. And I said, "I'm different because I'm the only one here that hasn't buried a child. And that's not right. It should be the other way around." But there's that many people. You mentioned those numbers in the beginning, and it's shocking to think that
60,000 of us were killed in 2016.
Exactly.
60,000, more than 20 years of the Vietnam War.
So think of 100... what if 100 dolphins washed up on Santa Cruz Beach tomorrow? Would the national media be here in droves? Yeah. But 100 bodies wash up sometimes daily from the opioid addiction, and there's not a peep. And then tomorrow another 100 dolphins wash up, and another 100 dolphins wash up. It would be outrage, but nothing.
You talk about knowing families who have lost two and three children.
Yeah. Yeah, that I used to host a radio show called Afflicted by Addiction, and I interviewed a family, the Davison family, and they had buried two sons that died about a year and a half apart from each other. And it was just, I mean, I could hardly keep myself together, and neither could the father. And I met a lot of parents that have buried a child, and it's the most catastrophic thing that you can ever imagine, what it does to them, and the constant reminders, whether it's their birthday or their day of their death or Father's Day or Mother's Day or Christmas or whatever, everything reminds them of it, and they live it for the rest of their lives, and what could I have done, and what have you. And then to bury two, and then I now know two families that have buried three children apiece, and it's just unimaginable pain.
How did we get here? I'm looking at this full-page article by Purdue Pharmaceuticals. They made gazillion dollars selling us opioids.
They're the devil
themselves. They have a plan, their whole marketing pitch, their presentation. Get ahead of your pain.
Right. Back in the day, Purdue was instrumental in the Get Ahead of Your Pain campaign, and there was really no proof that proved any of that, but they went out and marketed their products based on that. So they got doctors on board with all this prescribing pain meds, and that it was better for you to get ahead of your pain and be on these types of medication. But people were just getting on more and more and needing more and more, and when they couldn't get any more, first of all, your insurance will pay for all those meds while you need them. But when you need rehab, most of the insurance programs weren't paying for the rehab to get off of them. So there was really no exit plan to get these off of them. I've talked to people my age that have had, you know, I'm 59 years old, and I've talked to people my age or older that have had, you know, a hip replacement or a shoulder replacement, and counseled them through, okay, here's what's going to happen. You're going to get all these drugs, and you need to kind of, you know, you need to take them for your pain, but you also need to wean yourself off of them, because the doctors don't really have an exit plan for that. There are some drugs that will say, take one a day, then two a day, then three a day, then two, then one, then none. And that's really how you should treat kind of any of these meds. It should be your goal to get off of them. They should be a bridge loan to reduce the pain. But when I look back at my son, I would have traded a few weeks of discomfort for his lifetime of addiction. Because as a 14-year-old, he was addicted into his 20s. And
6 years of addiction in the most precious days of one's life.
Yeah, when he came out of rehab, my wife and I thought we should rename him, because he was such a different person. We didn't even recognize the way he acted, the way he was. He was enthusiastic and happy and energetic and talkative. And all the things he wasn't. We just thought he was just a really dark child, but he was just addicted for all those years and didn't want to be around family or anything else. He just was all about getting his drugs.
How did you hold your family together? How did your wife and you stay together? What was the glue?
There were some moments where we didn't think we'd make it. You know, it's tough. You blame each other. I know from a lot of the advocates that I work with, their marriages haven't survived it, particularly when there's a death. My wife would be the first one to tell you that she was the one that was in denial about all this. And I told her, I said, we're going to get that knock on the door. He's either going to be dead or he's going to be in jail somewhere. And fortunately, we got the knock on the door that he was in jail somewhere. And from there, we as a family, you know, did what we needed to do. One of the odd things I do that I kind of, you know, write about in my first book is that they tried to get my son to set up a dealer to get him off of, he was facing 5 years for possession and intent to sell and all these things, but he really just needed help. He didn't need prison, but prison would have been better than the streets. I mean, it would have been, you know, a step up. I mean, first thing for him would have been rehab, then prison. But then there was nothing else. So when your last two choices are rehab or incarceration, but we would have been happier than him being on the street with him being in jail. But nonetheless, they tried to get my son to work with them to bust a guy that was selling hundreds of OxyContin in the Sacramento area. And they knew my son knew him through their surveillance and through busting him. And it's a typical thing to get, you know, somebody sure to roll over on somebody up. But he was so unhealthy and so out there that he just couldn't do it. He could hardly hold his own head up. He was barely alive. So in an odd moment, you know, just like I volunteered to coach soccer, in the police interrogation room, I volunteered to go undercover. So I posed as a father, or as an old guy with a prescription. And my son
So you were the guy with the drugs.
Right. So my son told me, he said, this is what they look for. They call it harvesting. They find an old guy because it's a lot easier for an older guy to go in and say, oh, my back hurts, my arm hurts, I need these prescriptions, than it is for a 20-year-old. So I basically posed as an old guy with a prescription. I infiltrated their group, and I went undercover and got the bad guys. It was pretty touch and go.
And we are in a situation that's very touch and go. Ladies and gentlemen, the year 2016, 60,000 of us were killed by the opioid epidemic. 60,000. In the 20 years of the Vietnam War, 54,000 were killed. And we killed 60,000 in 1 year. Just 1 year with opioids. When we get back, I've asked Bradley DeHaven, how are we going to get out of this? What do you think? I did a little survey here in the radio station of the four of us in the radio station. All four of us have been touched by this epidemic to one extent or another. How about you? 831-479-1080. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So, Bradley DeHaven, tell us about the man and his workbench.
Oh, you know, people, having interviewed a lot of people that they'll do anything to get prescriptions when it gets right down to it. And they work doctors and multiple doctors, and they steal from family members. And they'll go into their aging grandfather's home and switch out their Vicodin for Tylenol without even thinking twice about it. They'll do anything that they can do. Anyways, this particular man, he couldn't get any more prescriptions. He'd tried everything. Everybody knew he was an addict. The doctors had shut him off and what have you. And with my interview with him, he told me that he decided that the way that he could get more opioids was to break his own leg. So he had planned to go out in his garage and pull his rather large workbench over on his leg. But he had the good sense of calling the ambulance first, because he was afraid he might pass out from the pain of it all. So he actually went into his garage, pulled this giant workbench over, put his leg on something, and snapped his own leg, compound fracture, just to ambulance showed up and took him in, and he got the drugs that he was addicted to. And it's that kind of desperation that really illustrates how far this will go. People always, they wonder, oh, how does this happen? Why don't they just stop? Well, it's well beyond why don't they just stop by the time that they're an addict.
So you wrote a book, How to Prevent, Detect, Treat, and Live with the Addict Among Us. Why did you put prevent there in front of everything else?
Well, I think that's the preferable method to prevent, because if you don't, then you're going to have to detect it. And if you don't detect it, you're going to have to treat it. And if you don't treat it, and even if you do, you're going to have to live with it. So I think that there are ways to prevent.
Yeah, but when it comes to preventing, nobody thinks they're going to become addicted until they are addicted.
Right. But let's look back and see what have I learned and what would I do different. And so that's how do you prevent? You know, you become the smart advocate. You don't have to take everything that your doctor gives you with and just trust that that's it. You can ask questions. There are alternatives to addictive painkillers. There's Motrin, you know.
Ice.
There's rub dirt in it if you want to get right down to it.
Jump off a cliff, you'd be better off. Right?
There's non-addictive alternatives that are preferable, and there's ways to get on and off this stuff. In the old days of take this pill, take four of these a day, if it's a pain pill, you don't take X amount a day. You know, you.
So in essence, to prevent, you have to be smart, and you have to be knowledgeable, and you have to learn to look that doctor in the eye.
You do, and you have to be aware of yourself. You have to go into these things. Whenever you put something in your mouth that's, a pill or something like that, you need to understand, how does this make me feel, and do I like that feeling, and should I like that feeling? Well, you've got to be willing, you know, too many people want to take another pill. Oh, when I take this pill, it makes me feel that way, so I take this pill to make me feel that way. You've got to find the baseline. You've got to get down. Myself, I've taken the equivalent of 1.5 Vicodins in the last 4 years. And I mean, I was in a lot of pain when I took, in the 1.5, I took a half at a time. But I know what those things will do for you.
Yeah.
You know, even my wife in a twist of irony was hit by a drugged driver, somebody high on their medications, and has been through almost 30 back procedures.
Oh,
and They prescribe her meds, but we watch those meds very closely. It has to be really bad to use them. We don't get ahead of them. We know what they do.
And you watch as well as she watches.
Exactly.
Right? So you're partnering up there.
You do. You need to watch that. So you need to be smart. You're in control of yourself.
Detect.
Well, you know, looking back, the detection was really easy. You know, there isn't a parent of a recovering...
Hindsight
2020. Yeah, there isn't a parent of a recovering drug addict that doesn't slap themselves upside the head and say, wow, that was pretty obvious. How did I miss all those signs? So certainly I tried to cover a lot of the method. I mean, drama, lies, absentee, weight loss, the eyes, whether their eyes are dilated or pinpoint pupils. Unnatural looks in the eyes, you know, like that. You know, look at your own eyes and look at your children's eyes. Are they dilated? Are they pinpoint? You know, are they, do they seem unusual? That's really a peek into the soul. But really,
you have to be suspicious.
You do. And you know, I remember my son afterwards, he said, you don't trust me. And I said, trust is earned. And it's, you need to earn it back. And it's not that I don't trust you. I drug tested him all the time when he came out of rehab. And I just told him, that's the deal when you come home. That was the deal I made him make with me. I didn't say, hey, when you come home, these are the things that you're going to do. When he was still in rehab, I said, I want you to write me a letter of the things that you're willing to do when you to come home. And one of those things were because they'll write anything. You know, he said, you can drug test me every day. And so when I would drug test him, he'd say, you don't trust me. I'd say, hey, you're the one that wrote it on a thing that I could drug test you every day. I mean, we need to know. And there's only you and the drug test know if you're clean. I don't know. So I've been through enough hell. Let me and your mother relax a little bit. This drug test is going to give us a lot of comfort to know that you're clean. So when you start acting weird, or when you broke up with your first girlfriend after rehab and you're getting really dark, and we see some of those same signs and symptoms that we became also accustomed to when you were addicted, we want to know that that you haven't turned back to those drugs to mask those feelings.
Treat? We have what? Treat?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Treating addiction is tough. I mean, it's the most difficult thing. It's like calling an ambulance, but you're picking out an addiction center. Because usually when you get into treatment, it isn't this, it goes over weeks. This is something that happens immediately. And you need to decide now, where am I going to send my child or my loved one? And how am I going to weigh what the pros and cons are?
And you're not going to do it in your own bathroom.
You're not going to do it in your own bathroom. You're going to go find a professional. You're going to take a leap of faith, and you're going to hope for the best. And you're going to pick the addiction that hopefully fits your family and your loved ones the best.
And it may or may not work.
It may or may not work. But you know what? It's a step forward, and it's a step in the right direction.
Okay, when we get back, a few more minutes left with Bradley DeHaven. Want to ask him the big question that is so hard for all of us, which is, how do we live with the addict among us? Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson, Bradley DeHaven, and you. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have an addict in your family, you have an animal in a cage. Bradley DeHaven?
Yeah, that's an analogy that I use quite often when parents say, you know, I don't know what to do, I'm trying to treat this. And I said, well, okay, an addict, consider it like if there was an animal trapped in a cage and you really wanted to help it. And you reach in there and you get scratched and you get bit, and it just backs up further into the cage, and that's further into the addiction. And you really need to take that cage, if you will, that attic, and you need to hand it to somebody that's a professional, and you need to, whoever that professional is, and you need to let them work on that, because that's what they do for a living. They get animals out of a cage, or they get addicts out of addiction. You don't do that for a living. You know, sell cars or work at a beauty parlor. I don't know, whatever your job is, I'm sure you do it well, or you wouldn't be doing
but
it.
But you don't do this.
But you don't do this. It's for professionals. So even though it's kind
and
of...
Even your wild animal in a cage will do everything it can.
Everything. It will do everything it can to stay in that cage. And you know, an addict's world becomes very small. So the cage analogy really works. You know, when I talk to my son, who loves to travel the world, he was in 13 different countries last year. He works hard. He has a wonderful girlfriend. He lives and provides for himself in San Francisco. And to see him flourishing like this and living life, and he would be the first one to tell you that when I was an addict, my world was so small, like a pinpoint. It was that small. I had to stay in my house. I had the drugs delivered to me. If I went out and got them, I brought them right back, or I had certain places
scurried
I could go.
Back home.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so their world becomes very small. So they are that animal trapped in a cage, and they need someone to help coax them out and work with them, a trained professional.
Tell us about what it was like when you brought your son home from recovery.
Well, everything had to change. The environment around there had to change. You have to consider that if they became addicted in that environment, then you need to change that environment. And it might even be your consumption of alcohol or your consumption of pills, where you put things. You need to, no matter where you are, if you have an addict in your family or not, you need to lock up your meds and you need to dispose of meds that you're no longer using. People bank these meds and leave them around, and addicts find them, and it doesn't matter if it's someone cleaning your carpet or going through an open house. Those pills are worth money and people steal them, and you need to help get them off the street. There's drug take back programs. There's all sorts of things that have progressed over the years that have helped remove these drugs and educate people and raise awareness about addiction, which starts in a little prescription bottle that's probably sitting in your medicine cabinet right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, 2016, a couple of years ago, 60,000 residents, citizens of the United States of America were killed by opioids. Is there any hope, Bradley DeHaven?
I think that there's hope. I mean, I think that a lot has happened. When I look back at my years in this advocacy, I've seen a lot of changes. Yes, more people are dying. That's a fact. More people are becoming addicted. But is there positive change? Yeah, there's positive change. There's awareness. I'm on your radio station right now. The President of the United States actually talked about prescription drug addiction. And whether you liked what he said or not, he talked about it. There was a day when I've stood with a bullhorn in Washington, D.C., yelling at Health and Human Services building and standing on the steps of the Capitol with, you know, a couple hundred parents that holding pictures of dead children. You know, those days are still necessary. Those events are still necessary, and they're still happening. But the fact is, when we were yelling at that building, nobody was listening and nobody was talking about it. Now they're listening. Now they're talking about it. There's awareness and there's education. I'm on your radio program right now, and that's proof of just that.
And so, I guess, you know, to save our country, we all must stand up and start yelling here.
Yeah, you need to become a student of the game. You need to understand everything in your life.
You have to be alert.
Yeah.
Because if you think it's not coming for you,
control yourself. Control your life, you know.
Control your lives of your family.
Yeah.
Folks, a big thank you for Bradley DeHaven, who is the author of A Suburban Father's Journey into His Son's Oxy Addiction. Also, How to Prevent, Detect, Treat, and Live with the Addict Among Us. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.